Coming up, it's all politics from NPR News.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm David Green.
And Ken Rudin is away. In fact, he's quite a ways away. And so we are lucky to have with us the star of this week's presidential news conference, David Green. David, what was going through your mind when you were listening to the president have his news conference before he went away to spend the rest of the summer in Crawford?
Well, he's gotten into this habit. Maybe it's almost a seven-year habit of not answering questions that directly at news conferences. So I thought I would try something a little off the news of the day. And I asked him about accountability. You know, he talks about accountability when it comes to keeping the public schools
accountable.
And there have been all these things recently where I think his accountability is coming in question. You know, he commuted the sentence of Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Libby. He stuck by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who's had some troubles. And he stuck by the Iraqi government at a time when people are really doubting him. So I asked him about accountability. And specifically, I think what we're going to hear in this little piece of tape is about Alberto Gonzalez.
Here's what he had to say.
I believe, David, we're watching a political, you know, a political exercise. I mean, this is a man who has testified. He sent thousands of, you know, papers up there. There's no proof of wrong. Why would I hold somebody accountable who has done nothing wrong? I mean, I think that's a typical Washington, D.C. assumption, not to be accusatory. I know you're a kind, open-minded fellow. But you suggested holding the Attorney General accountable for something he did wrong.
Thousands of papers. He's trying to say that Gonzalez has done everything necessary. He's done nothing wrong, and so lawmakers should get off his back. But I don't think they're going to.
Well, David, we have always thought of you as a kind, open-minded fellow. I'm glad to see that the president recognized that. But what kind of a news conference was this? Did you see the president as being a little low-key?
He was a little mellow. It was like he was already in this vacation mode, like he was already clearing brush on his ranch and not talking to reporters. I mean, you usually see him, you know, pounding the podium and talking about, you know, terrorism in Iraq. And this was kind of like, hey, I'm here. I'm doing these questions. I'm going to go off to Maine and visit my family. It was not the George W. Bush that we know very well.
That's right. Kennebunkport first and then Crawford. But it did seem as though one leg was out the door and one lobe was already back in Crawford.
That's right.
The president had a number of things to say about Iraq and about the situation there. He said that he still has full confidence in Nouri al-Maliki's government, and he did not seem to be in any sense overly distressed that the government there seems to be coming apart at the seams, with Sunni ministers leaving the government and with very little progress being evident, at least, towards the key pieces of legislation that the Iraqi parliament is supposed to pass to keep that country together.
Well, and not overly distressed about the fact that Nouri al-Maliki was meeting with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president. There have been a lot of questions about whether Maliki, a Shiite, would kind of get cozy with his Iranian neighbor. And the president was asked, you know, what about these images, these two guys standing there warmly greeting each other? And the president kind of said, oh, well, that's what leaders do when they get together. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're not bringing up some, you know, tough spots. They just kind of pose for cameras and look happy, which
and
the president's done before.
And, of course, Nouri al-Maliki is a Shiite, and Iran is a Shiite nation. And there is a certain cultural bridge there that may be stronger than Maliki's ties to some of the people in his own country, such as the Sunnis, who may have been more associated with Saddam Hussein. Questions to the president about the bridge that fell down in Minneapolis and what that might have to do with federal policy. Is it time to raise taxes for infrastructure? And questions also to the president about what's happening to the financial markets in the wave of the subprime loan fiasco, whatever we're calling it at this point. I don't know if it's a crisis yet, but still affecting the market, still roiling the financial markets. What assurance did the president have to offer on all of that?
Not a lot. On the bridge, I mean, he's a member of the Bush family, so talking about even the possibility of raising taxes is a huge taboo.
Oh,
it's a no-no.
Grab your tongue. Not that.
Yeah, so he quickly said, no, no, no raising of gas taxes. And then he blamed lawmakers and said, well, they should sort out how they handle transportation funding on their own, but no new taxes.
Prioritize building more bridges or reinforcing the bridges, but not with any new tax money.
Exactly, and a lot of reassurance about the health of the U.S. economy, but no real reason why people should be reassured. Just a lot of reassurance. It's okay, it's going to land softly, everything's going to be fine.
What about people who have a bad mortgage or maybe losing their homes?
Not a lot of guidance from the president.
Could the federal government possibly step in and have some sort of bailout for this whole situation to maintain proper or at least maintain a high level of liquidity so that the entire economy would not get into a credit crunch?
But the president used the word liquidity quite a bit. He said there's sufficient liquidity, and he talked about no bailout. But that's certainly up for debate right now in Washington.
Also up for debate, of course, are the nominations of both of our political parties for president. We're deep into the presidential season, and we're having debates, it seems like sometimes two or three times a week. The Republicans had a debate on ABC television Sunday morning. Then the Democrats had a debate on Monday night from Soldier Field in Chicago for the AFL-CIO. And there was a moment, I thought, in that debate where we might have seen the transformation of the political character we know as Hillary Clinton. Let's listen to this moment.
You know, I've noticed in the last few days that a lot of the other campaigns have been using my name a lot. But I'm here because I think we need to change America. And it's not to get in fights with Democrats. I want the Democrats to win. And I want a united Democratic Party that will stand against the Republicans. And I will say that for 15 years, I have stood up against the right-wing machine, and I've come out stronger. So if you want a winner who knows how to take them on, I'm your girl.
I'm your girl. Wasn't Whoa. That nice?
Yeah, well, a new moment, possibly. A new moment for Hillary, a new kind of, if you will, assertiveness. Not that she's lacked for some political spine and assertiveness over the space of her career, but this really seemed like watching her stand up in front of an angry Union Hall, 15,000 people in the audience, many of them shouting back at her, really kind of getting a new kind of religion right there on the spot.
It is going to be so much fun to watch how this campaign calculates when to use the fact that Hillary Clinton could be the first female president and when to sort of distance herself from that and not talk about that, you know, as a big deal, because she wants to say, you know, I'm a tough leader. It's not about my gender. So this was one of the cases where she just brings it front and center. She's a few times on the campaign trail. I've been really surprised because Hillary has said something to the effect of, I'm a woman, so I'm the person who should do the house cleaning in the White House. So I never saw that sort of thing coming from her mouth, but they're clearly trying to calculate the right ways and the right moments to appeal to a certain part of the female electorate, and it's going to be a tough dance for them.
She was also referring here to some of the back and forth between the Democratic candidates, some of which has been at her initiation. She went after Barack Obama on the question of some of the things he had said about unilateral action to eliminate the al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders who were hiding in Pakistan. He had invited perhaps some of this back and forth between the candidates, wanting to feature himself more highly in the coverage of the campaign. But then a lot of it has been coming back at her because obviously she's the front runner. She's ahead 2-1 in some polls. She's catching a certain amount of flack.
Well, and if we look back a month or two ago, a lot of the criticism of Barack Obama was he's not engaging Hillary Clinton enough.
Exactly.
So right now, what we can say with absolute certainty is these two are duking it out right now, and maybe John Edwards a little bit as well. Who that's going to help, I think it's yet to tell. We'll have to watch the poll numbers. But if Obama's goal was to really start getting things exciting and taking her on and bringing in a real debate, I think we've got it now.
I wonder if we'll start to see campaign buttons that say, I'm your girl, or she's my girl, or if this notion of having a kind of ironic use of the word girl by a feminist woman candidate like Hillary, if that will catch on, we'll start to see buttons and bumper stickers.
I think we might. And, you know, do you know his name is Ken Rudin? He hasn't been around in a while.
No, but I remember him. When you say button, it comes to mind.
It does.
Buttons and bumper stickers. In fact, I believe you got a message from Mr. Rudin this week.
I know you're missing him, and I know you're tearing up a little bit. And I hope I've filled this chair to some extent. But yeah, Ken is actually on the beach, and he wrote an email. I'm just going to pull it up here. He said,
"Have you got that on your BlackBerry?"
I do. Oh, you know, I have it in paper form. Can I pull it up on my BlackBerry? Yes, I have it on my BlackBerry, Ron. Here's Ken Rudin. The subject: Don't forget. And he says, there are bikinis all around me, but all I can think of is that you're going to be at the Iowa straw poll, and I won't. So please, 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 any and every button you can find.
Wouldn't you know Ken would vacation in a swimwear shop?
I would. And wouldn't you know he'd be thinking about campaign buttons when he's surrounded by bikinis. I'm sure that's exactly what was on his mind.
I think he might be showing up in Ames even though he's not supposed to be.
In a Speedo.
Even though he's supposed to be on vacation.
Just not in his Speedo. That would be unacceptable.
Ames, Iowa, home of the Iowa Straw Poll. What relation does the Iowa Straw Poll have to anything?
You could argue that it has very little relationship, and some people say it's just a big fundraising ploy by the Republican Party of Iowa. But let's not be so cynical.
Let's not be that cynical.
The party puts this event together, and you have to pay $35. I think it's gone up.
From $25 to $35
That's right. You know, the Republican Party in Iowa needs some money. The candidates try to bring people out to pay this money and cast a vote for them. And at the end of the day, they announce a winner. And how much it matters is a big, big question. But it's certainly some sort of measure of the organizational strength of these candidates in the state of Iowa. But some candidates are deciding not even to participate.
We should mention that it is only on the Republican side. There is no Democratic straw poll. It does not, however, have any direct relationship to the kind of event that's going to happen later this year or early 2008. That is called the Iowa caucus. This is a separate animal.
This is a separate animal. But the Iowa caucuses are going to be 2 days later after the straw poll. Is that right?
We'll get to that in just a moment. But before we leave Ames, Iowa, the candidate to watch on Saturday is clearly Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney. Absolutely. There's so much at stake because a lot of calculating going on. John McCain, mm-hmm. Rudy Giuliani, two of the other Republican frontrunners have made a decision not to participate in the straw poll. Now, they still can get votes, but they're not going to be there trying to gather people and part of the event.
They won't have a barbecue tent and a country
tent. No tent, right. No, you know, big beer bottles, overstuffed balloons to try and attract people to their side. And so there's a lot at stake for Mitt Romney. He's been leading in the polls in Iowa, whereas Rudy Giuliani has been leading in the polls nationally. So if Romney does really well, which his campaign is hoping for, he can say, you know what, I am basically, you know, I'm kicking butt in Iowa, and I'm the front runner. If he doesn't do well, you could see a Rudy Giuliani saying, you know what, I'm the national front runner. You know, what happens in this little game in Iowa, don't even pay attention to it.
Also, Fred Thompson, the other front runner who is not a candidate, has also decided not to participate in this, if you will, non-official event. He is supposedly going to declare sometime in September, and he could, of course, come in and try to compete here and steal a march on Mitt Romney, but he is hands-off at this juncture, not participating in any of the multi-candidate events.
But still the elephant in the room, not to continue using that pun over and over again, but yes.
We've talked about the people who are staying out of Iowa, and we've talked about why it matters so much to Mitt Romney to do well. Why wouldn't he do well if Giuliani and Thompson and McCain aren't there? Isn't Romney all by himself, or who else really matters there?
Well, it's the fact that McCain and Giuliani are not there has sort of opened the door for these other candidates who have been hanging around at 5, 6, 7, 8%. Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, Kansas Senator Sam Brownback, even Ron Paul, whose anti-war pledge has really attracted a lot of support on the internet, if not in the polls.
Even among Republicans.
Even among Republicans. And it gives them a window. And, you know, Huckabee, Brownback have been getting a lot of headlines in recent days in Iowa, I think in large part because, you know, reporters are always looking for headlines, and reporters are always going to cover the Iowa straw poll. And if you've taken out two of the front runners, then it opens the door for some of these other guys.
You referred a moment ago to the Iowa caucuses happening shortly after the Iowa straw poll, and it will seem like a short period of time, I'm sure. But just how short a period of time might it be? We suddenly are contemplating the possibility of Iowa having its caucuses in December 2007, before Christmas.
That's right. It used to be the Iowa straw poll was well ahead of anything serious happening. But now if it's moving up so significantly, I think it's actually going to be a race between when is the first significant caucus or primary and does it happen before or after Fred Thompson gets in the race?
Well, here's what's driving all this. You have a number of states, Texas, California, New York, the biggest states in the country, moving up their primaries from March to February, and not just any time in February, but the very first Tuesday, February 5th. And that was originally going to include Florida as well. Then Florida decided, no, we want to be ahead of those other mega states. So they moved up into January and landed on January 29th, which had been the date for the South Carolina primary. That, of course, was very upsetting upsetting to the South Carolina Democrats and to the South Carolina Republicans, who were going to come along on the subsequent Saturday. So now the Republicans in South Carolina have leapfrogged all the way up to January 19th, which also puts them in front of the state of New Hampshire,
which is
very bad.
Guards its position
very
closely.
Yes, their law, their state law, says they must be at least 7 days before any other state has a primary. Not caucus necessarily, but any actual binding primary. They have to be 7 days in front of it. So what happens now?
Well, it's almost a race. I mean, it's always a game of dominoes. And you can't overstate how important. I mean, as obscure as this calendar sounds and as we can joke about it, I mean, it is so, so precious to these states. New Hampshire has always counted on its people talking to candidates, you know, at their front doors and sort of sending a message to the rest of the country who's going to be the front runner. South Carolina has always been able to say, we're the first southern state. So, you know, what happens in Iowa, what happens in New Hampshire stays in Iowa, New Hampshire. The real question is, can a candidate make it in the South? And we, South Carolina, are going to decide that.
The Dixie trigger. And they have picked the Republican ahead of all the other Southern Republican primaries. They have picked the Republican winner ever since they invented the South Carolina primary.
Absolutely.
So it's been a biggie. That's it for this week's political podcast.
And you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm David Green.
And we've been very glad to have you with us today, David.
Thank you, Ron.
Ken Rudin will be back with his bikini next week.